Second guessing is something of a mug's game, I think. I mean, logically, I know that when things are done, they're done. But then if you're like me, what you do is you tend to replay them over and over in your mind. I am a terrible guy for saying to myself, you know what I should have said? Or if I'd only done this instead of that. And I was thinking a little about that after having moderated some of the All Candidates forums recently. Most of the time I was in the position of asking the questions for the audience, and which is a story in itself. But of course I was like, you know, everyone else in the room, I was really interested in the responses from the candidates. The way it worked was like this. I would ask a question, and then I would look over to them and see who wanted to respond first. And it struck me as fairly obvious, judging by some of the expressions I could see on some of their faces, that a few of them, it was like school, please pick someone else first, they were thinking. You could tell. And then there were some who just wouldn't even catch my gaze. They just would look forward. Do not look at me, teacher. And I took these responses to mean, you know, I need more time. Because they either hadn't thought of that issue before, or they'd misplaced the answer that they'd carefully prepared, or maybe they just didn't want to deal with that question for some reason, or I suppose in some cases they saw some strategic advantage in answering a bit further down the line. But then again, some rather bravely entered into the fray fairly quickly, and a couple of times I found myself thinking, you know, you might not want to have answered it quite that way. And on one particular occasion, perhaps you should have just taken a pass on this whole question. Of course, it was really, really easy for me to come up with just the right answer. I had brilliant and insightful responses. They were all available to me. They were instantly on the tip of my tongue, in no small part because I didn't actually need to answer. There was no pressure at all on me. Very much the backup quarterback with nothing but confidence. And so I was pretty much on the mark every time. I would have been elective with my responses. But that being said, I wouldn't have been at all surprised if afterwards one or two of the candidates may have been thinking to themselves, you know, what I should have said, or come to think of it, probably been better if I put it this way, or even, you know, I shouldn't have gone there. I hope it surprises no one here when I admit that I do that here all the time. There are all sorts of things that over the years I know I could have said better, handled differently, done better, maybe approached some situations that where we're to be together in ways that would have been healthier in the long run. It is simply the nature of the work we do, I suspect. And I'm sure that there are lots of other people in my position who would say the same thing. At least I think there would be. As many of you might have guessed, I've thought more than a few times as I've reflected on the whole situation of our sanctuary renovations. I particularly thought carefully over and over and over about the decision to move from using pews to employing chairs here in the sanctuary. Thank you for that, Camille. But you know, it's really been tough. It's been tough for a good many of us. And yes, I have wondered if calling for a vote would have made things easier. Or maybe it would have made things more complicated. I honestly do not know. I don't know. But despite the reality that it is indeed a done deal, I confess to some moments of, well, if only. I was talking a little about some if only thinking last week, wasn't I? When we were talking about that parable of the wise and the foolish bridesmaids. Like this Sunday's text, The issue of Jesus' return was a key theme last week, just as it will also be a key theme in our reading next Sunday. You'll remember that last Sunday's parable of the bridesmaids was the first of three parables we encountered in this 25th chapter of Matthew's Gospel. It is the first of three stories that Jesus told about judgment. And any talk about judgment sounds a bit unnerving, I find, anyway. Judgment is a difficult concept for us. It makes us uncomfortable. Though I am reminded of my United Church colleague from Ontario, a fellow named John Mache, who had a typically sharp observation. He said that without the possibility of condemnation, there is no need for grace. And he goes on, if there is no judgment, then there could be no justice. To have a loving and a fair God, that means that we will inevitably have a God who judges. And you will remember from last week that Greek word that gets used in the New Testament for judgment. It's that word krisis. It's a word from which we get our word crisis. And as we all know from personal experience, in a time of crisis, there is usually some form of judgment being rendered. There is an unveiling of what's really happening, some raw revelation of what is true. And that is usually unsettling. But despite that, it's not something we can avoid. In fact, to avoid judgment deeply distorts the gospel. The New Testament scholar Gerhard Loefink notes this: Jesus is rendered irrelevant when his preaching of judgment, which makes up a significant portion of the gospel tradition, is ignored, and there is talk only of the loving and tender Jesus. Encountering Jesus is the most wonderful thing imaginable, but man, it can be hard at times. So now we move into this second parable, about getting ready. And it's got a somewhat different focus from last week, in that Jesus is asking us to reflect on what it means to be productive. So let me recap the story for you. Jesus says that the kingdom of heaven is like a rich guy going off on a journey. But before he leaves, he calls his servants together and he hands over his property to them to look after while he's away. And he's got lots of stuff. He's got lots. The amounts that we hear about, they are really, really large. They are probably larger than Jesus' first audience could even imagine. To the first servant, he gave 5 talents. To the second servant, he gave 2 talents. And the third servant gets 1 talent. And we hear that those amounts are given in relation to their ability to handle that kind of cash. And as I said, we're talking about serious bucks here. A talent is worth something like 15 years' wages. So according to Stats Canada from February of 2014, I did some calculating. And if this scenario was being played out here in Canada in this year, 2014, that would mean that the third servant got $723,750. The second servant got $1,447,500. And the first servant was left with, are you ready? $3,618,750. And then after giving them the dough, the master skedaddled. The first servant with the 5 talents immediately went out and did some trading, did some investing, and wow, he earned 5 more talents. And the second servant did the same thing, and he earned 2 more talents. But the third servant, he hid the master's money in a hole in the backyard, somewhere between the potatoes and the turnips. And a long, long time passes. And the master returns. He calls the gang together and he asks them how they did. And the first servant, he presents him with more than $7 million. And the master is just overjoyed. He says, good work, Henrietta. That's really fine. Love what you've done. I want you to know that this is just a start. From now on, you're going to get into some really big stuff. Sister, the world is your oyster. So have a glass of punch. Try the hot wings. The party's on. That's what it says. Second servant, he steps up and he presents the master with just shy of $3 million. The master is like over the moon. He says, brilliant start, Vic. I really appreciate what you've done here, but we're not finished, you and me. We got bigger and better stuff ahead of us, so come on out here into the kitchen. Pour yourself a bubbly. Don't miss out on the crab dip. It's the missus' specialty. And then the servant who had been entrusted with that one talent, he came forward and returned to him the $723,750. And there was this long, long silence, and the master said, to which the servant responded, honestly? Honestly, I'm afraid of you. I've never really trusted you. I'm not even convinced that you play fair. So I hid that talent out in the back 40. It's all yours. It's perfectly safe. To the penny, it's here, just as you left it. And the master's shoulders, they just drop. And he says, aw, Harold, I think you got this all twisted up. You didn't trust me, your master, and yet I had confidence in you. I gave you a whole talent, $723,750. I gave it to you, and that's not chump change, bud. I trusted you. The point of this exercise was for you to do something with that cash, my friend. If all I'd wanted to do was keep it safe, I could have buried it in the backyard myself. Even a lousy savings account would have gotten me a percent or two. It's downright perverse. You tried not to do anything wrong, and you ended up not doing anything right. Harold, you could have come to the party, but you didn't trust me. It's like you don't even know me. If only. As I said a few minutes ago, the issue of the Lord's return is an important element of this particular parable, just as it was in last week's parable and will be next week as well. Last Sunday's story spoke about the issue of urgency and the importance of being prepared, being ready for that time of judgment, that crisis. And you'll remember how we reflected on the importance of being ready and preparing for these crises in our lives and those watershed moments that inevitably and unavoidably confront us, no matter who we are. And this parable of the talents comes at the issue of judgment in a slightly different way, though. But it is no less disturbing. See, I find myself rather liking the master's response to those first two servants. But the third, oh my. I mean, he just didn't want to risk the master's money. But that doesn't strike me as an unthinkable response. He didn't want to make it grow, true, but he didn't lose any either. I mean, if he'd lost some, well, fair enough, but it's a crime to just preserve it. And once again, I'm reminded that the kingdom of God isn't quite what I sometimes, usually expect it to be. There's judgment, but it's not the same kind of judgment that I would exercise. It's not what most of us would call fair. This doesn't give what I want or what I expect. And so I find this to be a really troubling story. And once again, I'm required to confront the reality that being a follower, being an apprentice, being a disciple of Jesus, it just isn't simple. Oh, yeah, choosing to follow is done really easily, but the actual following, man, it has its challenges. So I find. You know, that word, talent, in the context of this story, the way it was first told, and the way I retold it, that refers simply to a large amount of money. That's it. But sometime after the Bible was made more commonly available to the English-speaking world in the early 1600s, so about 400 years ago, that same word, talent, it was then introduced into our language as a reference to our personal abilities. It's a 400-year-old word for us. It refers to our aptitudes and to our skills, our talents. And I think that actually that's helpfully expands our understanding of the point of this parable. And whether or not God's given you a lot of money, which of us would be prepared to say too loudly that God hasn't gifted each of us with a lot of other things? I think your word gratitude might be on there, Alva. Which of us doesn't have abilities and strengths and friendships and opportunities? I think all of us do. I know you. Some of you quite well. You are a really gifted bunch. You have received so much. I mean, just living in this country means we have been given a lot. So the not unreasonable question this parable raises is, what are we doing with what we've got? How are those resources being invested? What are you doing with what you have? And maybe the sting in this parable is this, that what you've got might not really be yours. That these are gifts. Things offered to us for a spell, despite our protestations that we're self-made people. You know, that musical ability, that business acumen, that artistic gift. It's that word gift. That's the clue. That tells us something. It's a gift. You know, that warmth of character, that sterling intellect, that heart that you have for others. We are being reminded here that those things originate from somewhere other than us. And we get to grow it. We get to practice it. We get to refine, enlarge. We get to invest it, as it were. But what we have in our hands was first placed there by a most generous God. And to hide such thing away, to bury it, what value would there be in that? And true, there are times when we abuse or neglect those giftings, those talents that we are given. Sometimes our investments are poor. Sometimes we lose something of what we have. But my impression from this parable is that God would be much happier if we lose it in an honest attempt to invest rather than to simply maintain or even hoard it. Because those talents aren't really ours. They're God's. And the call is to use them to build up the body, to build up God's church in some way, some place, some time, somehow. So you're still not convinced that you've got much to give away, that you might not have something to invest? Okay, let us make the most generous assumption that you are the one person in this congregation who doesn't have much of anything. Let's just start there. Maybe you are that one talentless person. You are the one here this morning who has nothing in the bank, is deeply in debt, has creditors as far as the eye can see. You have no special abilities. You are the embodiment of the report on Fred Astaire's screen test in RKO. Can't sing, can't act, can't condense some, you know. You're not much anything. I don't for a second believe that anyone here is like that. There's anyone here who doesn't have talent without some valuable resources. But for the sake of argument, let's give that one to you. Let me grant you that one. Hey, you're still not off the hook. Because you are, by your presence here, the possessor of the greatest gift to ever hit humanity. You've run into Jesus. You have received the gift of life, and we dare to believe it is even eternal. And with that gift, there is a call to invest it. to live on the edge and to risk giving that gift away. It does not get buried in the ground. It does not get like caught like some fly in amber. It's to be invested somewhere in someone. And if they don't take it, well, we move on. But we keep investing. We keep giving it away to anyone who we have the privilege of knowing. We give like we have received, with gratitude. And we have received, each of us, far more than we can truly imagine. So yeah, this is a tough parable. I know that. It is a parable of judgment. And Jesus is warning us about the danger of all the if-onlys. In this case, of the danger of failing to risk. Of the danger of failing to truly live the life of faith. There is a well done, good and faithful servant waiting for us as a church community. It's waiting for us as individuals. No if-onlys, okay? Amen?